closer.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
We're almost at like 80 episodes, and still every time we start, there's a weird technical glitch.
There's something or other.
We're in a weird haunted theater right now.
Have we started?
Sure.
Cool. Welcome to Two Magicians.
You do it.
Welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic. I'm Simon Coronel.
And I'm still Nick Paul.
And we are currently sitting in the actual theater at Magicopolis in Santa Monica in L.A.
Now, for the late people, what is Magicopolis, Simon?
Magicopolis, as far as I know, I'm not an expert, has been running for many, 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 many years, owned by Steve Spill, a legendary comedy magician. It was basically his venue. He ran it. He did shows here. Did, like, I think, kids' birthday events during the day, his own stand-up comedy magic show at night. And just very recently sold it to new management, who are doing a soft reopen right now, this weekend. It's currently, we're recording this on Saturday the 10th of August. And this weekend, Nick and I are doing shows here for the opening.
Yeah, and that's kind of the elevator pitch that we got yesterday, because we both showed up.
That's all we knew.
Didn't know anything, and friends of ours were very confused when we said we were performing here, because they're like, wait, they don't hire other magicians.
Yeah, that's just Steve's thing. That's all he does. So no one really knows about this yet. And we realize now that we got asked to do it because they needed grizzled showbiz special forces veterans who could deal with what... Because the new management who have taken over, great bunch, I don't know like exactly the ownership dynamic, but they knew that like the theater, they haven't even begun reworking it yet. They don't know how any of the lighting, any of the sound, they just haven't had time to look at it all. It's literally just changed hands. And also, the place is nice, but it's a bit old, it's a bit run down. It was all set up for Steve's show and nothing else. Plus, Steve, knowing he wanted to sell it, hasn't been actively marketing it for a while. And so they knew the marketing was like, so they just didn't know what was going to be happening. Who's going to show up? Is anyone going to show up? How do the lights work? How's the sound work? What's that? They just knew nothing. But they needed somebody, so they called us, because we can deal with anything.
What's fascinating is that it's kind of a great... It does mean a lot when you're brought in to be like, okay, you guys know what's up, and you're going to basically be thrown, you know.
Yeah.
Not, I mean, to the sharks is kind of a bad metaphor, but really, like, I think if we were less polished, we may have freaked out, especially in today's experience where it was smaller house, and we're like, well... We both had the intuition without even saying it to go, let's do a more intimate close-up show for these people.
Oh, yeah. If I'd done this gig 5-6 years ago, I would have like frozen and panicked and freaked out and gone, I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. Whereas as it was, we're like, all right, here's how we can do this. Let's handle this.
Here's how, because I think we've all gone through the experience of, you know, doing a show and going, all right, this should have been here's what we should have changed before the show started. And now we both have that kind of instinct of, okay, this X, Y, and Z needs to be changed right now, even though we're about to walk out on stage. Let's change everything. And it makes it more exciting, I think, for the audience and for the people coming in. And for you as a performer, for me, I had a great time in that last little close-up set
did.
And if we did it, you know, in the way we were supposed to do it, I don't think it would have been
fun. Last night's show, because it's two evenings and two matinees, Friday night, a 2 p.m. and an 8 p.m. today, and then just a 2 p.m. tomorrow. Last night we had about 15 people turn up, I think, which in, what's this, we're in about 160-seater, 120-seater?
140-seater. Which is a huge, it doesn't look this, like it seats this many, but it does.
So we had 15 people in 140-seater, which is not a great, obviously that's a very small crowd, but no problem. Dealt with that kind of thing 100 times before, and the way you deal with that is basically walk out, acknowledge the fact, hey, very welcome, very small crowd, but we're glad you're all here. Thank you for coming. Cool. You've acknowledged the elephant in the room. They feel comfortable now. You feel comfortable. You go ahead. You connect with the crowd. And it was actually a really fun show. Whereas today, 4 people turned up for the 2 p.m. show. Now, that's 4 people in a 160-seater is a lot tougher than 15. They're both small, but there's small and then there's small. So, yeah, we both realized, you know what? Let's take them into one of the other function rooms. Like, this place has so many rooms in it. And, like, rearrange the chairs and put together an impromptu little close-up theater and do an intimate show for them. And that went great. Again, knowing when to make that call, when to not make that call. And like you said, the intuition from experience.
Yeah, it's neat to be a part of something. Because, like, so many, like, the amount of people, like, reaching out to both of us saying, oh, how do you get booked for that? How does that happen? Oh, that's cool, they're doing this. But in reality, we are, you know, kind of glorified guinea pigs, for lack of a better term. But it's really neat to be at the starting position of something where, okay, this is the transition. This is like, this place has the potential to be another kind of magic castle.
Oh, massively.
And we are at the beginning of it. So, yeah. And so many times, I think, for both of us, we've walked into things that are, at least, you know, performing at the castle or places like Comedy Magic Club, places that have been established for 30, 40, 50 years. And so you show up and go, okay, there's this expectation. But now it's interesting to be at a point, I think, in our careers where we could look at it and go, oh, man, nobody showed up. When you look at that in a positive way and go, oh, this is really neat. This is a new challenge for us to, okay, how do we get this word of mouth thing to begin? How does this buzz start? And I think yesterday's show, everybody walked out of there and went, oh, we're going to tell people about this.
Yeah, oh, that was really cool.
We didn't know this venue is transitioning into something else.
Well, it was funny today. We had two magicians come in who came in because, yeah, Magicopolis, that's where Steve Spill does shows. They didn't even because the website hasn't been updated yet. Again, that's how new this is. It changed hands all of, like,
literally 8 days.
Yeah, eight days ago.
Heard about it. Yeah. So it's brand new. We both got booked for this, you know, a week and a half ago, yeah. I think.
And it's exciting because the team behind it, I'm just sort of not mentioning them just, if in doubt, you know, just in case.
Don't want them getting emails.
Yeah, like, or whatever. But they know what they're doing because they were asking us last night, hey, okay, based on what you just did, any input? Because they want to totally overhaul the venue, which is great because the venue's cool, but it does need that. They were going, all right, what would make your jobs easier? What would make you able to do better shows here? What are the angles like? What's the lighting like?
Yeah.
And they're really looking to performers for feedback, which is great. It shows they get it. And I consequently have a lot of faith and excitement about what this place could turn into under that kind of enlightened management direction.
I've thought a lot about, I mean, I have a bunch of friends and we've both worked at this kind of new renaissance of, you know, it's kind of like what the 80s were for stand-up. There's all these clubs popping up. And this place has been around. It's established. It's a different type of thing. But just witnessing it from the other end and seeing, okay, what it takes to actually run a venue.
Oh, yeah.
Just... Ooh. You the concept of work and the time and the perfection that has to go into it is pretty astounding. And it's a full-time, 24/7 hour gig, which is crazy.
Yeah, well, also because here, I mean, as I can't remember whose line this was originally. I think it was something John said way back, a venue manager who said, all right, everyone, remember, they've hired some great performers. All right, guys, remember, our job is to sell food and beverage. And it's absolutely true. The job is to get butts on seats, get ticket prices sold, get drinks and or food sold. And here it's now a bar and theater, and both are full-time management jobs to make both of those things work independently and together. It's a massive undertaking.
Yeah.
And props to them for taking on that challenge. I wouldn't. I would not run a venue. Hell no.
Yeah.
No way. That is out of my skill and comfort set.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a bad time for me.
Yeah, it takes a village for sure. They're doing some good work. You just got back from Magic Live. You did a shoot, and we can now talk about.
We can talk about it. That's what we vague casted it last time.
That's a big honor to get asked to perform at one of the maybe biggest convention for magicians in the world.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest three or four in the world.
And
I mean,
being performing for an audience of, you know, people that pretty much know what's going on.
Yeah.
That's got to be a weird... I may have done one or two conventions, but it's always weird to me when I perform, even if it's just a theater of magicians. I get very in my head about that.
Yeah. I mean, I have so many thoughts on it. I don't even know where to begin. And I'm still... Right now, I mean, it's Saturday. I got back from Vegas yesterday and drove straight here and did last night's show at Magicopolis, soon to be renamed, I think, as like the Illusion Bar and Restaurant or something, Bar and Theater. And I'm still just fried. I am shell-shocked. And because this morning, last night I had about 9 hours of sleep, and I'm still wrecked because that was I think it's been about a month since I had... like even 8 hours of sleep. It's been nonstop because it was Melbourne Magic Festival, then the stuff I was doing in Chicago, then straight back from that into crunch time prep for Magic Live because the show we were doing was such a vast project. Like, I mean, I mentioned last week, it's huge. So what it was, we can now go into detail. Shoot Ogawa and I, we've been performing together on and off for a few years now and doing this kind of collaborative show idea very occasionally. It's not a full-time thing at all. And the concept of the show, it began as just two of us in the Pella at the Magic Castle doing a show. It gradually grew last year at FISM to include a third performer. Last year, Magic Live had some challenges with its gala shows, to put it charitably, had some moderately janky gala shows. And so Stan Allen, who runs the Magic Live convention, former editor of Magic Magazine, knew he had to kind of pull out something much better for the gala shows. Shute had the idea to approach him to do a version of our show expanded to include many more performers, so that we would essentially be doing our show as a wrapper around the gala show to give it kind of an interesting, quirky, unusual narrative while having lots of guest acts. And the benefit from our point of view is we now get our show on a big Vegas main stage, and we get the cred that comes with that. We get the video of that. Because to a lot of bookers, that really, what's the word, validates, like gives the show credibility. Mm-hmm. That, oh yeah, this is a big, serious show. This is played a Vegas main stage in a, like, you know, 1,000-seat venue or whatever. As opposed to them thinking, oh, it's some little thing you did in the Pella, right? And like, no, this is a big deal. This is a serious thing. And for Stan, he gets a show that's at least more polished and has a cool concept that's going to play well with that crowd, probably, if we can get it together. But the challenge for us is we had to massively rewrite the show to include all these additional performers. So by the time we'd finished, again, to cut a six-month-long story short, the show had, I think, 8 performers in it over the course of about a 60-70-minute show. And even though it was Shute's idea to do it, for a bunch of reasons, I ended up being the one kind of in charge of the whole production, because Stan and the team had things they needed. They needed a certain number of acts and a certain kind of feel. We had things we needed in terms of the structure of the show. Shute had things he wanted. I had ideas. And like the light and sound team had certain constraints on what they can do in the venue. Is there certain lighting for certain magic effects? And by the end of it, I was the only one who kind of knew all the different parts of the pie. So while doing things like Melbourne Magic Festival and all this other stuff, in the background, I've been trying to like assemble and deal with all this insanity for this gigantic monstrosity of a show. And so the fact that it ended up going really well is such, like, this is the first time I've been able to just not think about it for so long. I'm so happy. Mm-hmm. I'm really happy it went well. I'm even more happy it's over. And I can just relax now.
Was yours the one that had the Lance Burton cameo?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I heard about that. I mean, I can cut this out if you want it to be a surprise.
No, this but is cool. It'll never happen again. Like, the show will never happen again.
I was
going
to say, I don't know how you're going to keep getting Lance Burton to show up in your shows.
This was unique for Magic Live. So what did you hear?
I heard he showed up out of surprise, in a cloak of some sort.
So one of the things that because every show, ideally, is written for that audience and that venue to some degree. And so this is a magic convention. The audience is entirely magicians of whatever level. So we put in a lot more. Every time Shute and I have done this show, it's been, the core concept is the same, in that you're seeing backstage and front stage at the same show. That's the core idea. The show starts backstage. So it's a magic show within a play about a magic show, is essentially what's going on. So for this, we wrote in lots of bits that were very Magic Live specific. There are a lot more magic in-jokes in it. And one of the things we wrote was the mystery guest turns up backstage in a cape, a hat, a scarf, and sunglasses, so you can't see their face. And it's this whole, the mystery guest. And then he walks out while the show still stays backstage. So you've got, oh, cool, yeah, oh, man, the magician's going to love seeing you. This is awesome. Thanks for coming. And he just nods, and you can't see who it is. And then go knock him dead, and he walks through the curtain. The implication being you're not actually seeing his performance. So he's now gone out front, but that's not what's on stage. And you go, oh, man, they're going to love him. And that got a massive laugh because that's funny. Like, you've built him up, and then you don't actually see him. So then while he's doing his act ostensibly out on the front stage, while the show is still in the backstage scene, a bunch of drama happens, and this whole plot plays out as we try and, like, fix our finale that's broken and yada, yada. And then at the end, you hear applause from through the curtain. He finishes, comes backstage, bowing to the crowd, so facing away from the actual audience. And as he walks off stage with his assistant, who's actually doing a quick change act backstage, as though she's changing clothes to go back out again. So it has a quick change act that's done as a throwaway. So there's a lot of different reversals of subversions of familiar magic tropes. He walks off and we go, hey, how did it go? He turns around, takes off the hat and sunglasses, and goes, it was great. And you realize it's... So in the first show, we did 3 shows, had to repeat it 3 times. First show, it was Lance Burton, which obviously the audience lost their shit. Second show, it was Matt King. And third show, it was Max Maven.
Oh, cool.
So we had a different cameo in each show. And he's like, it was great, and walks off the stage. And that's his only bit. So it was a really fun moment. And there were lots of moments like that, like clever little fun things that were... would play to any crowd, but were way cooler to a magician crowd.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of like the neat thing about, I mean, with the internet, and it's a good and bad thing to have kind of niche things out there that, you know, you can do shows for specific audiences. Yeah. But there is something pretty cool about being able to tailor a show custom to, yeah, you know, what the audience is going to get, and you know what, yeah, they're, you know, thinking, and, yeah, and how much more joy they're going to get out of this.
Well, that's one of the great things that Shoot and I have sort of half accidentally, half deliberately stumbled onto over the last 3 years. I think we've been doing variants of this show concept. And again, it's not really a show. It's like a concept that we rewrite a bit each time. It's very modular. The core structure of the show stays the same, backstage, front stage, but within that we can change up the material, we can change up what the drama moments are backstage, and the idea is now we can do it anywhere in the world, find local performers who are good, and then kind of over even just a couple of days easily write them into the show with just, mm-hmm, changing a few lines and concepts. So it really blends in. They turn up backstage, we have an argument, something's gone wrong, but then we go up front stage and do that bit of the show, the guest act is introduced. So it's this really sort of modular kind of meta show that's, mm-hmm, I'm really excited to see where it goes and do more work with it.
Mm-hmm.
And after Magic Live, like, a few people saw it. There's a few more touring opportunities have come out of it, which, again, is half the reason we did it, as a chance to get it out there and grow, yeah, it and show it can be a bigger production.
Yeah, that's kind of what we're working on with this Magic Showdown show.
Yeah.
If anybody wants to see it, we're doing it in Bloomington, Indiana. I want to say the dates are September 26, 27, 28.
That sounds about right.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
If you just
be
Google
a lot of
fun. Magic. It's Magic Smackdown at the moment.
Isn't it Simon Cornell's name? There's this picture of you and like lightning bolts behind you, I discovered.
Did we talk about that last time?
I didn't Google the image until after.
Oh, yeah,
and
the image is pretty
amazing. Hilarious.
If you Google Simon Cornell. Quote unquote, Simon Cornell's Magic Smackdown.
It's kind of everything I hate about Magic, but I'm like, you know what? I don't want them to change it.
Yeah,
I want to keep it because that's amazing. Kind of,
it's a bit like, I mean, the Lance Burton, Matt King, Max Maven cameos. It was particularly funny because Lance is the most famous of the three. You know, it's a holy crap, it's Lance Burton. But it was almost
because
funnier.
He's retired.
Yeah,
the other
exactly.
two people are still performing.
And then Matt King is still, it's great, it's Matt King, that's funny. But it was almost funnier with Max Maven because while the bit is happening and he's ostensibly doing the show out there behind the curtain, the Kayla, the woman who's coming through doing the quick change act, she's bringing props on and off stage, ostensibly to be done in the act that you're not actually seeing. And they're all hilariously generic magic props. Like, one's like a feather flower production, one's like a dove pan with a toy rabbit in it. And so the revelation at the end that, like, it's actually Max Maven who was doing this completely generic, goofy, almost kids' magic act is actually an almost funnier subversion,
yeah,
at the end.
A man who's known for doing very psychological, yeah, deep thinking, you know, mind reading.
Yeah, and so the Simon Cornell's Magic Smackdown image kind of works like that, in that it's me who attempts to be mm-hmm. dignified and erudite and shit, being like, lightning bolts and magic props. Mm-hmm. And it's very funny.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I'm looking at my calendar, and it's kind of nice that a lot of the upcoming gigs, even this week, I'm doing the Castle with a friend of mine, August 14 to 18. So if you're a magician member and want to check it out, come on down. It's cool to be, okay, so more and more shows on the calendar are kind of more fun group shows. And then I still have a mix of ones that are there to pay the bills. But it's good that the goal of doing more of this is starting to happen.
And, yeah.
Keeping that in mind and keeping that the focus is good and helpful.
Yeah. Well, that's also why it's exciting to be working on Showdown / Smackdown. It's exciting to be working on this thing with Shoot because, like, any one given project, as we know, is unlikely to succeed. And by succeed, I mean really take off into something really
good.
Yeah,
I mean, we've been doing this long enough to know that this could fizzle out and could just be a once-in-a-while thing, and that's fine.
Or this could finally be the thing that actually really takes off and gets us career traction. You just don't know. So much of it's out of your control, even if you're really talented and hardworking and blah, 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 all that crap. But most of it's luck, as we know. So it's good to have a few different projects that all have potential. Again, if a thing looks really promising, it's got about a 5% chance of working out. Mm-hmm. That's what we've learned over the
years.
Well,
we were just talking here with the owner, and I mean, I brought up my father-in-law gave me some great advice a couple of years ago. I said, oh, this product, I forget what I was talking about. I said, this thing should sell itself. And he goes, nothing sells itself. And it was kind of a revelation because it seems so simple. But,
yeah.
I mean, especially, you know, in the venue we're at now, the marketing and the angle they need to take in order to grow it into something else. And then these shows we're working on, keeping that in mind of it's nobody, there's just so much content and so much stuff out there. Nobody, it's like people are walking past the venue here. And like very few were just walking in out of curiosity. Yeah. They need a reason to come in. They need either somebody telling them or something that catches their interest. And it's, you know, pitched to them in a different way.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the biggest misconceptions about the entire arts and entertainment industry, that from people not in it, they think that if you're good, wow, you'll just get gigs and you'll be, it's like, oh God, no, it's the biggest misconception that just being good is enough. No, you've got to be so much more than that. You've got to be hardworking. You've got to be lucky. You've got to be out there just working every angle, doing everything just to, but all of that's invisible to the average punter. So, of course, they don't realize, which is sometimes annoying in terms of the inane comments you get about, wow, you must be crushing it. It's like, no. Well, I mean, yes, like now in some ways, because anyway, it's a whole thing.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm in that zone now of we talk about these things that are happening, but at the same time, we still have to stay hungry and we still have to keep pitching it and selling it. And I'm just in a spot now of just being so drained and just... Yeah. Finding the excitement and the, I don't know, whatever that spark inside you is, I mean, it comes and goes for me. And I wish that wasn't the case. Yeah. I can feel it, especially even today we're talking about this stuff. It's like, man, I really would like a day off. And then you think back and go, okay, this was the goal. The goal was to be working full time and, you know, working on various projects like we are. So it just, you know, kind of shut up and enjoy
God,
the ride.
No, enjoy it. Like when we were talking to Dom, he's like, screw you guys. No, this is great. Yeah, be grateful. And it's right. That's why I'm basically taking the next week and a half off. I've got a few things, but just easy, chill things, because my God, I knew going into Magic Live that I would need a break after it, because it was going to be, I mean, almost literally infinite work, because there was so much more work. It would have, and the shows were not perfect by a long shot. They were very rough. There were a lot of missed cues. There were a lot of fumbled moments. And like, there was no way that was not going to happen. That's absolutely like unavoidable when you're taking on that big of a challenge with that little time. Because we only had, I think, 7 hours of rehearsal time in the venue. And that's not even close to enough. Like, it would have taken like 4 days of rehearsal to get that show tight, like at minimum, to really get it properly tight. So it was rough, but it was good enough. None of the problems were critical. And that's also, I think, one of those big misconceptions people have that stops people attempting big, bold things, is they think it has to be perfect to be adequate. And it really doesn't. It just has to be good enough to be good and worth people's while.
I was just chatting with DMC, because he was here. He has a great show on Netflix called Death by Magic, and they just happened to come into the venue and checked out our show. And we were chatting a little bit. A few of the people that work on Magic for Humans worked on his show, and we were talking about, he made a great comparison about, you know, you spend, you know, in stage magic or stage performing, you spend years honing it and getting it correct. And in cases like your show or, you know, shooting a TV series, it's very often that you will get everything, like the trick or whatnot, or the idea will change last minute and it has to be shot because that's the scheduled time. And he made a good point of, you know, no comedian is like writing a joke and then putting it out for thousands of people to see, you know, right after that. That's kind of the difference of what these type of projects are. And that's been a very eye-opening thing. I never, you expect things to be kind of perfected and you expect everybody to kind of know exactly what needs to be done. And then you realize you get to these points and these neat career opportunities and you realize everybody is just improvising.
Oh God, yeah.
Experts at what they're doing, but they're still just making it up as it goes along.
Because there's no way, again, whichever general it was, like, no plan survives its first contact with the enemy. And it's a similar thing. When you're out there doing these things, like, there's no way you can plan for every foreseeable eventuality. So you always, I mean, look at today's 2 p.m. show. We had people turn up. We had to completely change the show. We moved it to a different room. Everything was overhauled instantly in a heartbeat. And that's why, again, one of the best things that any human being, not even any performer, can study is improv, like improv acting. And the problem with, this is also a side note, one of my pet peeves is when people give a recommendation like, study improv, that's a good thing to do, go do improv classes. And or in magic, read books, that's a good way to learn magic. And they neglect to take into account, that's only good advice if you can find a good improv teacher
yeah.
or read good books, and everyone neglects that, because if you just go and study improv at some janky-ass, dumb improv group that are just about going for the gag and not thinking about the actual narrative and character structure, it won't actually teach you useful lessons.
Yeah.
You won't learn much
You'll
from it.
You'll think you're not good at it. You'll
yeah.
think, you oh, this isn't for me.
Yeah, or that it's not useful, or you won't gain any actual benefit from it, or it's...
I went from training at Second City in Chicago, which is like the mecca of improv, to when I moved to Florida, I took a local improv class because I was, you know, I hadn't done it in a year or so, and I wanted to get back in. And A, I was terrible.
Yeah.
But B, just the way the class was run in the group I was with, nobody, like... It was almost anti-improv. It was anti-group. It was anti, you know, yes-anding, thinking, you know, as one. And it, if I had never taken improv or done improv before then, I would have been like, oh, this is awful. What are people talking about? So you're right. It's all how it's, you know, taught and all how it's given out.
And yeah, and that sort of gets into it. It's been a recent thing, just unrelated. One of my pet peeves in magic is when people go, oh, learn from books, read books. Like, that's terrible advice, because unless you tell them, read this book, like, that's interesting, that's good advice. Like, read Maximum Entertainment by Ken Weber. That's good advice. Read books is useless damn advice, because most books are shitty.
Even,
most DVDs
even just,
are
like,
shitty.
General literature, like, even classics, you go back and go, this is really tough to read.
Yeah.
Have you tried reading War and Peace?
Yeah.
It's long.
Because the world changes, times change, language changes, things that were once good get superseded. And there are, it's not that there are not things to learn from that.
Mm-hmm. And it's not that they're not important either.
Yeah, I think Royal Road to Card Magic is a terrible book for a beginner to learn. It's just a bad book.
I have it. I can't get through it.
No, it's a terrible book. It was good. It was good in like 1930 or whenever it was written or whatever. Back then it was good. Books have got better. People have got better at writing books, better at writing educational books.
Yeah.
And times have changed. Because Royal Road, like, it teaches you good techniques, but magic isn't just technique. It's also about performance and presentation and audience connection. And if you follow the instructions in Royal Road as they're written, you'll be terrible at actually connecting with a crowd, because the language is out of date, the verbiage is out of date, the societal concepts are out of date. There are much better things you could read than that.
And I think, importantly, it doesn't tell you why. Okay, why are you doing this in the first place? Yeah. That's the biggest thing in the arts that I really struggle with, and I kind of overthink, because... there isn't enough of an explanation as to, okay, why is this happening? What are you feeling right now? What's the motivation for, why are you playing that song that way? Or why are you learning the piano? You know, where does that come from? Not just, okay, this is how you play piano.
Yeah. And whereas, and I think Royal Road and Bobo and Tarbell, I think, is a great book, but terrible for a beginner. Like, they're like, it's a great resource, but bad for a beginner, because it does a terrible job of guiding a beginner who knows nothing through the experience of learning magic. And most people who go out on the read books, books are the place to go, most of them, from what I've noticed and I would theorize, also had real people guiding them and teaching them.
Yeah.
And they've forgotten that. They've forgotten the privilege they had, that they had an actual human being or several humans teaching them and showing them so they could see the performance.
Yeah, this judgment against watching videos to learn was like, well, there aren't. You can't, if not everybody has a resource like, you know, a live performance to see on a weekly basis.
And
so that's what how they're getting
And
it.
A lot of advice is given with very subjective constraints the giver often is not even aware of. Mm-hmm. Like, I now have learned so much from reading many, many magic books, and I would recommend them very highly, only if you also have live people and or videoed performances to also help you learn from. Yeah. And, you know, like, I think anyone should read, like I said, Maximum Entertainment. Any magician should read The Experience of Magic by Eugene Berger, but neither of them alone is enough to teach you how to actually do magic. You need a live teacher and or, much worse but better than nothing, videos, videoed performances to see how do you perform this? How does this technique actually work as an illusion? Because as a beginner, I learned nothing from books technique-wise. I learned more important things. I learned theory. I learned concepts. Like, again, Eugene Berger's Experience of Magic was one of the best, most valuable things I ever read in magic. But it didn't teach me anything about how to actually do magical technique and actually amaze somebody. I learned nothing of that. I learned other things, but I needed that, those things from somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we've angered all the old people that listen to this podcast.
Whatever. I mean, they're wrong. That's okay. That's all right.
Not even old. I mean, I just think there is a side of magic that sees it that way. And
well, you end up with these sacred cows. Like, learn from books. That's a concept. And again, study improv. That's only good advice if you know. like, again, one of the best things I ever did in my life was spend a year with the Spontaneity Shop in London studying their improv courses. I could not tell you if doing any other improv course is worth your while. I don't know. I can only speak for that one, mm-hmm. because they're all completely different based on the teacher and the ideology and the flow. I mean, I did Avner the Eccentric's workshop recently up in Maine. That was amazing. I'd recommend that highly. I can't tell you if other clowning workshops are going to be worth your while.
Yeah.
All advice has to be really specific to the situation and the person taking it, mm-hmm. based on other variables. And maybe someone who's never done that before wouldn't get as much out of those as I did. It's all very subjective.
Yeah, I think that's something I almost need to go back. I need to go back and take an Avner class. I need to get back into... Because you kind of get set in your ways of, well, I've been doing this a while and I know how to do this.
Yeah. Oh, God, no. When no one should ever stop. No one is ever in a place where they don't have infinite things to learn. Mm-hmm. What you know is dwarfed by what you don't know, and should probably, if you want to keep adapting and evolving and improving, keep learning. Like what I'm capable of doing now, I could not have even imagined 5-10 years ago. And so how am I supposed to know now what will be capable of 10 years from now? Mm-hmm. If I keep discovering things I can't even imagine yet.
Yeah. Well, you're giving me great notes today about, you know, ways I'm presenting the talking portions of my show, and still a relatively newer thing for me to be so focused on scripting and so focused on, you know, getting the talking portions of the show correct, because it's, you know, I have so much experience doing the physical stuff, but jumping back into talking. Mm. And for the longest time when I was talking beforehand, I was just kind of improvising my way through, and sometimes stuff works and sometimes it didn't. So now my goal is to get better at the scripted portions of the show and being able to jump in and out of improv. And that goes back to the reason I brought that up was because just knowing that, okay, this is what I need to work on and this is what I have to get better at. And I think if you're at a position of, well, I know how to do this, you can't, I mean, as we often say on the podcast, you can't grow as a performer.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's an old concept, the beginner's mind. Always have the mind of the beginner. You are always, what you don't know is always greater than what you do. There's always a billion more things to learn. No one's an expert on everything, even almost anything. Even the things you're an expert on, what you don't know about that is so much vaster than what you do know.
That's something I've been learning, you know, just working on the Netflix show, and then even just like coming to places like here, working on a ship with a tech crew, of just being open to... okay, I don't have all the answers, and knowing when I have to put my foot down, but trying not to. Like yesterday we had an experience where a gentleman was super helpful, but he was, you know, he almost could have got very badly hurt.
Yeah.
And both of us were like, okay, this needs to stop.
Yeah, there was an occupational health and safety issue yesterday and who knows, that's the thing. You can't measure what bad things were prevented. Because you don't know if they would have happened if you had or hadn't.
Well,
stepped
we were
in.
Talking about that Nicolas Cage movie where he sees 2 minutes in the future, and I think both of us saw like, what was going to
this
happen.
Could potentially end very badly.
In 120 seconds.
Not risk that happening.
Yeah, but yeah, just knowing when to listen to that instinct and when to go. Okay, let's hear out the crew, or let's hear out. We're in their space, or we're working with people that. I mean, I heard this from. Who created Funny or Die with Will Ferrell. Adam, blanking on his name, darn it, director, did Vice, did a bunch of a bunch of great movies, and brilliant comedy. Writer, was on SNL for many years. Mm. Anyway, he said, the biggest thing I've learned as a director is to not micromanage people and to not, you know, feel the need to be in control all the time. And I think once you can step back and know when you have to take that position of, okay, this is what needs to be done because no one is figuring it out or no one has given me the correct answer is kind of a helpful mental place to be in.
And that's the other thing is sometimes good ideas can come from, like, you can... I remember way back, someone who's an idiot. It's this guy I know, obviously I won't name names, Magic Castle, Denizen. Guy's a self-indulgent moron. Thinks he's great, isn't. Is an idiot, but one time, and is often given just stupid notes that are just like, no, that's not a good idea. But one time, it's more than zero, gave me a great note. He said, you could do this. And I went, whoa, that's actually a great idea. You never know. Mm-hmm. Even the dumbest person or the most idiot person is capable of sometimes, you know, stop clock is right twice a day. You never know. You never know where wisdom, that's right, wisdom can be found in the most unexpected places sometimes. So it's always worth keeping open-minded. Even if 99% of the time there's nothing, that 1% can be solid gold.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to growing, but it also just goes to, you know, getting to the next level or figuring out, you know, okay, why are you doing this in the first place?
Yeah.
Of needing to, I don't know, I lost my train of thought right there.
That's okay, that happens.
That's, yeah. But I guess we should get ready for a show to do.
That's true.
Some people
keep the people happy.
This
is kind of cool. I mean, yeah, we are just sitting in the seating of this 140-ish seat theater, looking at the stage we're about to perform on in just under an hour.
Mm-hmm. It's weird. Most theaters, you're kind of in line with the stage, or a little bit lower. This one, you get higher.
Higher or lower? It's the most intensely raked seating. So the frontmost row of seats. There's what eight rows. The frontmost row is very far below the edge of the stage. Topmost row is very far above. It's a very steep angle of the audience seating, which means you can see dead on every single person's like entire torso, not just head. It's a very bizarre room, but not bad. It's kind of a cool space.
Yeah, I think it's going to be something pretty special in the next couple months or so.
Oh, this has got great potential. I'll be so enthused once they overhaul it, redo the decor, fix the lighting, just get it nicer. This has got massive potential to be a really cool venue. And it's in Santa Monica, which is a great part of LA.
Mm-hmm.
It's really nice just being down here, away from the Hollywood grind.
Yeah, all these fancy, beautiful people who live here in Santa Monica.
And also us.
And us. They allow us in for a couple hours every
weekend. Wait, we were both just self-deprecating. Mutual wrist slap. Stop it.
No, you walk around. Everybody's gorgeous.
Well, there is that, yeah. This is actually quite a special
place. I'm not comparing them to me. You just go. I heard it recently that LA is the spot where all the beautiful people from all other parts of the world show up. I've noticed it. I mean, you notice it, but then when you look at it from that lens of just everybody migrated from, you know, whatever part of the world they were to here.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not, you know, that's just how it works here.
Yeah. But even then, it particularly congregates within certain subparts of LA, e.g. Beverly Hills, Santa Monica.
Yeah.
Less so in, I don't know.
Burbank.
Exactly.
That's why I hide out in Burbank. I fit right in with the normal looking people.
Well, we get to leave this episode on an unusually forward, upbeat note. We're off to do a show.
All right, let's do it.
This has been Two Magicians and One Mic.
And that's it.
Done.
Bye.
Peace out.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcast. If you really like the show, you can donate a few bucks a month on our website, twomagiciansonemic.com, or become a monthly subscriber through our Patreon link. Thanks to all the people that support the show and keep it up and running. Be sure to follow us on the interwebs @twomagiciansonemic. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.